This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Psychologist David Walsh is our guest in this portion of the program. He says some of the results of failing to see the importance of the word no and failing to use it with children and adolescents include impatience, lack of respect, and a need for instant gratification. Dr. David Walsh joins us this afternoon to talk about when and how to use the word no in what he calls our culture of yes. David Walsh is the president and founder of the National Institute on Media and the Family and the author of No, Why Kids of All Ages Need to Hear It and Ways Parents Can Say It. He's a frequent guest on television and radio, including PBS and NPR, and we're very pleased to have him with us this afternoon. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to the book No, Dr. Walsh is the author of four previous books, including Why Do They Act That Way? A Survival Guide to the Adolescent Brain for You and Your Teen, and Dr. Dave's Cyberhood. His book No, Why Kids of All Ages Need to Hear It and Ways Parents Can Say It is now available in a paperback edition with a discussion guide from the Free Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Walsh, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure to speak with you. You know, one of the things you ask parents to do early in this discussion, this thinking about no in your book, is an exercise to think seriously about what kind of an adult they hope their children will become and what admirable traits they hope their children will have. And then you ask, okay, how do we do that? How will we get from here to there? Would you like to talk with us about the value of this exercise?
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start, because one of the central tenets of the book, No, is that the culture of more, fast, easy, and fun makes us very short-term oriented. And part of what we need to do is take that long-term, that long view. You know, what kind of adults do we hope our children grow up to be? And when we start to identify the traits that we hope that we will have, that they hope that they will have, then we have to start to figure out, okay, then how do we help them get from here to there? Because it's not going to happen by automatic pilot. And a lot of the short-term decisions that we make, so in other words, we're in the middle of the supermarket and our 8-year-old is screaming for a candy bar. And the short-term solution is to give him the candy bar, because that might, that might pacify him. That might, that might calm the tantrum. And so we get the short-term relief. But what we're perhaps doing is building a long-term pattern, which isn't going to get us to that trait of the ability to delay gratification or the ability to kind of have self-discipline, which is going to be crucial to their happiness and to their success.
Yeah. Speaking of the store and candy bars, you tell a story in the book about a conversation you had with Santa Claus about
yes.
about some overblown expectations.
How appropriate at this time of year.
Oh, amen. Yes. So how did Santa handle the requests of the children he visited with at the mall?
Well, you know, Celeste, the that question is so timely, because the conversation that I recount in the book is with Santa Claus, and the conversation took place 2 years ago. Well, by coincidence, this past Sunday, I saw that same Santa Claus again, and we literally had a revisiting of that conversation. But for your listeners, the Santa Claus that I had the opportunity opportunity to interview has been the Santa Claus at the Nordstrom's at the Mall of America for over 13 years. And when I asked him over a cup of coffee, when I was writing the book, when I asked him over a cup of coffee, have you seen a change in the kids' wish list, I couldn't stop him from talking. He said that the change is so quick and so dramatic. You know, he said that when the little ones, and of course we're talking about children that sit on Santa's lap, we're not talking about the tweens and the teens here. He said 13 years ago that the big ticket items, the main thing on their wish list for Christmas might have been $40, $50. He said now it's an everyday occurrence for the little ones to ask things that cost $100. Mm. And what he did as Santa Claus is he tried to tamp down those kids' expectations. You know, so he would tell them things like, well, you know, Santa Claus is not real good at electronics. Me and my elves are good at some other things. And, you know, and you might need to pick out one or two things on that list that you really want to get. So what he tried to do is help shape the children's expectations. And what he was doing at the same time, he was really helping parents and giving them some scripts that they could use to kind of help children develop some realistic expectations, because, of course, one of the unfortunate things that happens at the holidays is that while we do want, we do want the gift giving and the surprises to be a pleasant part of the whole holiday experience, every year we have families who, you know, those bills come in January and they've just dug themselves into a hole, and they've really, they've really overdone things. And so getting some kind of balance, I guess, is what this is really all about. Santa Claus helped those parents and continues to help those parents do that, but we have to learn how to do it ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Is it harder for adults today to say no to children than it was a generation or two ago?
Absolutely. I think it absolutely is, Celeste. I don't think that today's parents are any less motivated to do as good a job for their kids as parents have ever been, but I think the job today is much more difficult. I think my mother was good at saying no, and I think part of the reason she was is that there was a culture that supported it. But today, parents are surrounded by, you know, a constant drumbeat of yes messages wherever we turn, because the culture today, largely driven by the media, and as you alluded to in your introduction, I'm a student of the media. I've founded the National Institute on Media and the Family 12 years ago and have been studying the impact of media on all of us. But the media are very, very good at shaping values. Whoever tells the stories defines the culture. Well, the traditional storytellers are now being crowded out by the electronic storytellers, and they are very good at promoting four cultural values: more, easy, fast, and fun. And I think when we hear a constant drumbeat of those messages, then it's harder for parents today to counteract that more easy, fast, and fun, and teach their children the critical success factor which is self-discipline. Because the goal, even though the book is called No, the goal is not No. The goal is to help kids be able to say no for themselves. The goal, No is actually the road to yes.
Right. That's the final chapter of the book.
No, that's what I call the final chapter of the book, That no is not the destination, it's the road to yes.
Yeah. You point out that this isn't about being, you know, an authoritarian, about being a drill sergeant. You
right.
say saying no in the wrong way or in the wrong situation is just as bad.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you pointed that out early in our conversation, because the book No is not a call for kind of a boot camp approach to parenting. We've learned a lot about child development in recent generations, and part of, I think, what happened, Celeste, is that, you know, many of your listeners may recall that it was just a couple generations ago that parenting wisdom was children should be seen and not heard, and spare the rod and spoil the child. Well, we've learned enough about child development to know that is not good parenting advice. But what we did is, when we realized that, we didn't correct, we overcorrected. And we overcorrected, driven by a culture of more easy, fast, and fun. So what we're really talking about is establishing balance. And as you indicated in your question, we're not talking about a drill sergeant approach. We're talking about a very balanced approach to instilling in our children the success trait for them, which is self-discipline. So there are times to say no, and there are thousands of ways to say it without ever using the word, because it's really not the word, it's a strategy. And it's a strategy to help our kids develop those inner muscles, so to speak. They're going to help them be successful and, ironically, happy.
Hmm. Now, I've got a listener who would like to talk with you, and we're going to go to that caller in just a moment. But maybe you can give us an example of how you can say no without using the word.
Yes. A lot of times it has to do with giving kids choices. So, you know, one of the things that I tried to do in the book is provide tons of examples and stories as well as specific, you know, strategies for using. And so, you know, when a child, for example, one of the anecdotes that I recount is my own parenting experience. When Brian, our middle one, was about 3 years old, he's now an adult, but when he was three, I still remember the night that, he refused to eat his dinner. And rather than get into a power struggle with him, what I said is, Brian, you know, we had planned, it was a summer, hot summer night, said, you know, our plan is to go down to the Dairy Queen and get a treat for dessert. But dessert comes after dinner. If you don't eat your dinner, then there's not going to be any dessert. And after making sure that he understood that if he didn't finish his dinner, then there wasn't going to be a Dairy Queen treat, then I let it go. Well, the proof of the pudding came, of course, a half an hour later when we were standing on the corner waiting for our Dairy Queen, and Dan and Aaron ordered theirs, and Brian looks up at me and says, I want a vanilla cone. And then it was my job to remind Brian, no, Brian, you made the decision that you weren't going to eat dinner, so there is no cone for you. And, of course, you know, he did what little kids that age do. He cried, he screamed, he whined, you know, he called me mean, and all of those things. My job at that point is to make sure that I hold fast to the consequences, because he knew the choice that he had made. And it's all of those little mini lessons that are so important for children to learn. And, of course, there's thousands of them a day. Rather than saying no, rather than saying don't stand on the chair, we can say it positively. Stand on the floor.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, very good. And no should not be a signal for maybe.
No. If kids learn, and that doesn't mean that we can't negotiate. It doesn't mean that, you know, there's a line drawn in the sand that will never change. But we need, the kids need to know that they can count on us to be consistent. They can count on us to be firm. See, it's their job. It's the child's job to test the limits. It's our job to set them.
Yeah.
And if the limits are elastic, then the children are very, very quickly going to realize that.
Yeah. Let's take a call now. Our guest this afternoon, psychologist David Walsh, author of No, Why Kids of All Ages Need to Hear It and Ways Parents Can Say It. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Let's talk with a listener now in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Very interesting topic. I find it amazing that it seems that we tend to blame media for every fault in our society today. And I'm just not a believer in that. I think where we as parents fail, and it's pervasive in our society, is that what we want to do is be our children's friends and not parent. And you just can't, in my belief, is that you cannot parent if you want to be your friend, a friend to your child. I'm a firm believer in that. And I do agree with one of the last statements I heard, and that is that parents have to be firm. You know, no shouldn't mean maybe. It should mean no. But today I think we're just a little bit too lenient, and we tend to, we don't put the burden that needs to be there on the child. And that's my comment. And very interesting topic, and I'm enjoying every minute. But for debate, what does the doctor think about that?
Well, I completely agree with your listener, Celeste, and I didn't mean to indicate that the media were entirely responsible for this. I think the media are a powerful force, but getting back to the listener's comment that it's a parent's job to be a parent, not a friend, I completely agree. Children hopefully have a lot of friends, but they only have one or two parents, depending on whether it's a one or two parent family, and you know, what we need to do is be the parent. And that, you know, that means loving them. That means connecting with them. That means being in their corner, supporting them. And also, it's our job to help them learn how to manage themselves. And that's where being a parent comes in, not a friend. You know, if I'm a friend, what I want to do is always have my child be happy. And too many of us have become allergic to our children's unhappiness. And sometimes kids need to be unhappy. Sometimes, you know, we're not going to deliberately make them unhappy. But if unhappiness is the road to a very important lesson, we, of course, want them to learn that lesson. And if we're always bailing them out, if we're always doing for them what they should be doing for themselves, if we're always, you know, battling teachers, you know, it takes 1,000 different forms. But I guess I'm rambling a bit, but I do want to say that I do agree with your listener that the greatest gift that we can give to our kids is to be good, loving, caring, consistent, firm parents, and then they'll have lots of other friends.
Yeah, a woman I know puts it this way. She says, "You know, I just have to think I've got big enough shoulders."
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You know.
Yep.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, psychologist David Walsh. Listeners, you can join us with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, how good do you think we are as adults in terms of self-discipline, in terms of saying no? We're not going to.
That is a great question.
I'm not going to do that.
One of the first presentations that I made on the topic was to a group of parents in New York City. And after the presentation, a woman came up to me and she hit the nail right on the head. She said, "You know," she said, "you're absolutely right, Dr. Walsh, but the first person I have to say no to, learn how to say no to, is myself." And as she was listening to what I was saying, she was reflecting on the fact that she doesn't say no to herself. And, you know, children have never been very good at listening to their elders, but they've never failed to imitate them. And so if we, you know, if the model that we're giving is that we never deny ourselves, then that, you know, kids are going to pick up that message. And, you know, Celeste, this is really showing up in the workplace. And so one of the surprising and pleasant reactions, actually, to the book No, it came out last January, so it's been out for about 11 months. But one of the surprises has been the reaction of the business community. I mean, it's a parenting book. It's a book for parents, but the reaction of the business community has really taken me by surprise. And so I'm getting invitations to speak to business groups because they're seeing it in the workplace. They're the biggest concern, and when I say what I'm going to say next came from a survey that was done by the Conference Board, which is the organization based in New York of America's largest corporations. It's the Fortune 500 companies. And when they did a workforce readiness survey about a year ago, the biggest concern of America's business leaders about the people coming into the workforce, the big surprise in that survey was their biggest concern is not skills. Their biggest concern is work ethic. What they said is, you know, we can teach the young people the skills, but they have to be willing to work hard, delay gratification, cooperate with others, all of the ingredients of self-discipline. The other thing that's been a big surprise to me is how how this concern spreads beyond the United States. The book No came out in January, and translation rights have already been picked up in 9 foreign languages, 9 foreign countries, including, interestingly, mainland China. Their one-child policy is causing some real concern that a lot of the children are not learning the message of no.
That's interesting. I've got another caller who would like to speak with you, so let's go and take this call now. Urbana, line one, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. We have a 20-month-old granddaughter who has been biting when she's frustrated, both at daycare, it started at daycare, and now she's doing it at home. How can we help her express this differently? What would be helpful to say and do?
Yeah, I would. It's a great question and an important one because you know what she's needing to learn, particularly at this age, is the appropriate way to express anger.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's angry. There should be a consequence if she bites someone else. You know that, and the consequence could be, you know, a timeout, a short timeout. At that age, you wouldn't want the timeout to more than to be just a couple of minutes. But it could be a timeout. It could be that she can no longer play with the child that she bites. If she's biting an adult, then there should be a consequence for that. So there should be a consequence that really gets her attention, and then to help her understand, and this is where a real firm no needs to be real clear, you know, you cannot bite other people under any circumstances. And there are ways, and help her start, if she's developed some language, help her start to identify some other ways that she can, you know, express her anger. But she needs to learn very clearly and very consistently that biting is not okay ever.
Okay, so if she bites her mother, what would be a possible consequence?
There should be a very firm and immediate no, and then there should be a consequence for that. And it could be that she has a timeout.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that whatever activity she wants to do, you know, so if she's biting because she's frustrated because she can't do something that she wants to do, then she doesn't get that. So she needs to know that biting does not get her what she wants.
Okay.
And so, you know, if I want a cookie and I don't get it, and then I get angry, so I bite mom in order to get the cookie, well, then there's no way you're going to get that cookie. I mean, you have just ruled out the possibility of cookie
mm-hmm.
for the next hour or two. And of course, for children at that age, their time, we have to be realistic about their time span.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything needs to be immediate and short term.
Mm-hmm.
And then she needs to be, the other part of it, the other side of the equation is rewarding her when she expresses her anger without biting.
Okay.
And so it's what I call in the book catching kids being good. And so there's two parts to the equation. One is making sure that we respond to the behavior that is not okay, and the other is we want to make sure that we reward the behavior the behavior that we want. So when she is able to express her anger appropriately, then we want to say, good girl, you know, you're acting like a big girl now. That's the way big girls do it. So you give her something to shoot for and make sure there's a reward when she does it right. We want to make sure that we reinforce that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Does that help?
Yes, it's very helpful. Thank
you. Good.
Next, we talk with another listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to see what you thought about this right here. I'm working on becoming an elementary school teacher, but currently I teach in a private preschool and daycare as well. But what I'm hearing a lot of right now is it seems like this is an embracing of kind of like an authoritarian approach towards parenting. How do you feel about the other aspect of parenting, which might fit another idiom or personal approach, like, for example, a more nurturing model.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, we've just been talking about biting
mm-hmm.
and saying, you know, a firm no what I've believed for a long time is that children really do just want attention. I mean, at the end of it all, they crave attention and love. And one thing, like, for example, for biting, is that you can put your foot down and provide a solid no and denial of rewards, but you're still focusing attention on them. And perhaps the more nurturing approach, one thing that I've done, is that the way that you dole out care or attention is important too. For example, with biting, if I ever have to deal with a child that's biting, the first thing that I do is focus all my attention on the child or that has been bitten, and the person that the child that has done the biting is left with an example where this kind of behavior does not get them what truly motivates them, which is a desire for attention and love. And also with nurturing, I'm just curious how, this is a kind of an aside, and you can address it whether you wish to or not, is that I kind of have in the back of my mind an idea that this sometimes equates to a person's politics as well. Like, for example, people that believe in authoritarian models or believe in nurturing types of models have a certain mindset that affects other examples of their life, like the choices that they make. And you can feel free to comment on this anyway, and I'll hang up and listen.
Boy, this is a great set of issues, and I really appreciate the call. Well, first of all, I haven't done a very good job of describing what I'm recommending if it's coming off as authoritarian, because that's not the style of parenting that I am recommending. It's not the style that I'm trying to describe, nor is it the style of parenting that I talk about in the book, No. In fact, I specifically in the book, No, have a whole chapter on styles of parenting and talk about the shortcomings of the two extremes, which are authoritarian on the one hand and a laissez-faire or permissive on the other. What I'm really recommending is a balanced approach. So in the example of the previous caller and the biting example, I think you'll recall that I said you don't just tell the child no, but you also, when she does behave properly, that you make sure you give that lots of reinforcement and praise and thank you. And doesn't have to be, you don't want it to be lavish or it will come across as phony, and kids can quickly figure out what's phony. Your comments about the underlying motivation for children's misbehavior is to get attention. What I would say is that is sometimes true, but not always. The child who bites isn't necessarily doing that for attention. The child who bites may be doing that out of frustration, may be doing that out of their inability to express anger in an appropriate way. And so attention-getting behavior is important to pay attention to, but I don't know that I would agree that all children's behavior is to get attention. I think it's an important motivator, but not the only one. So I think how you described responding as a teacher, how you would respond to pay attention to the children who had been bitten. I think that that's fine. I also think it's important that the child who bites hears very directly that that's not okay. And so I guess that's where I'd have a little bit of a difference of opinion, that all child's misbehavior is in order to get attention. I think there are multiple motivators for children's behavior, both good and bad. The last comment about different approaches to parenting correlate with different political approaches. That's an interesting comment, and maybe there may be something to that. I have to think about that some more. But my guess is that the caller would probably make a mistake in guessing my political, based on this conversation, might make some mistakes in terms of guessing my political leanings.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Psychologist David Walsh, our guest this afternoon on the program. His latest book, Know, Why Kids of All Ages Need to Hear It and Ways Parents Can Say It. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. And listeners, if you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, give us a phone call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. And our toll-free number, it is 800-222-9455. Another listener in Urbana, line one, hi.
Hi. I would like to get back to your example of how businesses are getting interested in this idea and concept. The observation that one often makes is, for example, industries that are making hundreds of millions of dollars red ink turn around and they're managers get a nice bonus of several million dollars. And that naturally is not going to be sitting well with the employees. It's a parallel to parents saying no to themselves while they want to say no to their children.
Mm-hmm.
And similar observations can probably be made at all kinds of institutions, including institutions of learning and research, that managers expect employees to postpone gratification while rewarding themselves or their cronies. I wonder if that observation is off mark on my part. What do you think about it? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't think it's off the mark at all. I think, in fact, interestingly, in the opening chapter of the book, No, I talk about how the versions of our inability to manage ourselves really start to show up in corporate America with some of the same examples that your listener just offered. So I guess it's an example of how we need to be able to say no to ourselves. And I think that if we were to use the analogy of a business as a family, thankfully some boards of directors are now waking up to the fact that it really doesn't make a lot of sense to reward an executive who has not done a good job. And I think we've all heard example after example of that in the last in the last several years. It's a little bit scary when there are so many corporations that have been led into scandal by irresponsible executives that Forbes magazine actually has to start to run a website keeping track of them all, and that is indeed what has happened. The focus of the book is more on parenting, and the listener's question makes the implication to corporate America, and I think it's a valid implication and something that we need to pay attention to.
Yeah. Well, also in the realm of politics, you can't
yes.
get very far today by
right.
not promising the world.
Absolutely. In the last chapter of the book, I draw the contrast between 1964 when 1960. Got to get my years straight. When John Kennedy's famous inaugural address. He was elected in 60, so this was January of 61 when he made that famous statement: "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." And so that was a generation where sacrifice was considered something that was patriotic. And now, I quote a commentator that I heard interviewed about a year ago who said the last thing a politician ever says now is call for sacrifice because they won't get elected.
Mm.
And that's a, you know, that's something, that's another one of those kind of societal implications of this erosion of self-discipline and the need to be able to delay gratification, to sacrifice for a greater good, to put other people's needs on a par with my own. And we don't learn those things automatically. We learn them by being taught them. And for children, that is outsourced. Children don't learn that by themselves, and it's our responsibility as parents, as one of your listeners pointed out several minutes ago, it's our job as parents to teach them that, because it's for their good, and ironically, it's for their happiness. That's the amazing the thing about this. One of the most striking experiments that's been done on this was done years ago, back in the 1960s, when some Stanford psychologists did the famous marshmallow experiment. And what they did is they invited 3- and 4-year-olds into their parents volunteered 3- and 4-year-olds to come into this study. And after they came in, the parent was invited to go to an adjoining room and watch through a two-way mirror. And then the psychologist presented the little 3- and 4-year-olds, they were there individually one by one, with a choice. And the choice was this. Here's a marshmallow. You can either eat this marshmallow now or wait until I come back. I'm going to go on an errand. When I come back, I'm going to have more marshmallows. Now, if the first one is still there, I'm going to give you more. But if you've already eaten the first one, then I'm sorry, you won't get any more. After making sure that the children knew the choice that they had, then the psychologist left to join the parent and watch. Well, they recorded every child. Some of the kids ate the marshmallow before the door was closed. Other kids did whatever they could to avoiding eating that marshmallow. Celeste, they had recordings, they still have the recordings of kids who were looking at the ceiling so they wouldn't see it. They had little 3- and 4-year-olds walking around the room singing at the top of their lungs so they wouldn't think about it. Some of the kids ate the marshmallow, some of the kids were able to wait. The genius of the experiment was that they followed those kids for years and years afterward, through elementary school, junior high school, post-secondary into early adulthood. The ability to wait for that second marshmallow was an amazingly strong predictor of their success in school and their happiness and adjustment. Because I think that experiment was a very clever way to measure the success trait that we've been talking about for the past half hour, and that success trait is self-discipline.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello, I am very pleased to hear our guest today, and I hate to say this, but I think there's a lack of this kind of dialogue on these programs, and I would encourage you to have more like this. But in particular, Dr. Walsh, I'm concerned about our girls and the kinds of images and expectations that are set forth by the media and emphasis on girls' looks, on being skinny, on getting boys,
yep.
In particular on the Bratz dolls and the Barbie dolls, and a reference to a book that is currently being written by Diane Levin called So Sexy, So Soon.
Mm-hmm.
And my concern is that the people in the choir are aware of these concerns and are trying to do something about them, but in your parenting institute, do you have any special efforts that are going out to parents to help them to make better choices for girls?
Absolutely. And as the father of a daughter, I completely share your concerns. One of the things that I said early in this conversation with Celeste on WILL today was whoever tells the stories defines the culture. And that's not true. It's been true for thousands of years. But today, the storytellers are predominantly on the screens, and they have a tremendous impact on defining the norms, what's desirable, what's the norm, et cetera. And, you know, we could have a whole conversation just about that and the volumes of research that have confirmed that. And that's why politicians that are running for president are raising millions of dollars to get their messages on all the screens, because they know that they're so influential.
That's right. And I think, too, I am as concerned as anyone about the products, the inferior products of toys and that come from China. But I'm also concerned about the quality of the social quality of the toys that are coming from anywhere for girls.
Right. I agree. And Diane Levin from Wheelock College in Massachusetts, I think, is the woman that you're talking about. And she has done a tremendous amount of work in this area, as have people like Jean Kilborn, who has done a tremendous amount of work of how the media have really portrayed girls and women in a very highly sexualized and objectified way. And it's a very important issue. And your last question was, does the National Institute on Media and the Family address that with parents? The answer is absolutely yes. In our various education programs, we try to help parents understand how the media impacts us in many, many different ways, whether it's violence on the media promoting aggression or whether it's the objectification of our daughters that leads to all sorts of problems for both, not just the girls, but for the boys as well, in terms of how they learn to treat and look at girls.
Yes, I appreciate that, and I appreciate your comments, and I hope that the parents who are listening are going to take note of what they're giving the girls as gifts.
Mm. And that gets us to a big question and an important one, and I want to get to it right now. You know, when you look out, this holiday season is a big time for cultural storytelling.
Yes.
When you look at the movies, TV programs, video games, and other media and products aimed at children, including toys, what do you see that's good, not so good, and not good at all?
Yeah. You know, I think what the recipe for a good toy or a good video game or a good program is a product which can simultaneously and engage and entertain a child while at the same time helping them learn. See, because children's play is their important work. They're learning all sorts of things when they're playing, including attitudes, including things like cooperation, getting along, all sorts of things. And so, you know, if we look for and it may not be necessarily the best-selling toy or the best-selling video game on the market, may not be the one that's doing it. And so when we look for things that really our kids are going to be interested in, because we want them to engage in it. I mean, we don't want to give them something which, you know, we think, well, this is going to, you know, reinforce some good values, but it's completely boring. That's not going to do the trick either. So the real challenge is to find the toys, the video games, the television programs that do both. The good news, Celeste, is that they are there. I mean, there are, for example, video games. you know, a lot of people think that I am anti-video game because I'm often critical of the bad games, but I'm not anti-video game. I believe that there are good games out there. The problem is that so many of the games that are promoted, so many of the games that are popular with boys, the underlying theme is violence and, you know, and things like that. And so it's just making good, informed choices and thinking about the lessons that our kids are going to pick up from these television programs, movies, video games, or toys.
Yeah. One of the things that comes across or came across to me again and again throughout the book now is the importance of connection, human to human connection. So I would think if you're looking for something for kids, you know, get them out of the bedroom. A woman told me, you know, I don't know what's going on. My granddaughter's bedroom looks like a theme park.
Yeah.
Get them out and get them engaged with other people.
Absolutely. Connection is the bedrock underneath all of this, and I'm so glad you came back to that because I meant to mention that earlier when an earlier caller thought that I was promoting an authoritarian approach to parenting. I meant to mention at that point, so I'm glad you reminded me, of the underlying structure, the underlying the thing that really builds the positive parent-child relationship is that connection. Because once that connection is firmly established, then the child is motivated to keep it in place. The child does not want that connection to be fragmented. And so when I approve or disapprove disapproval only has sting if there's a good connection. Because if I disapprove of what my child is doing and I have a good connection, then that disapproval is going to threaten that connection. That's going to be motivation for them to change their behavior so they don't lose that, so they don't get more of that disapproval. Disapproval has no sting at all if there's no connection. What do I care whether you don't like it?
Yeah, wow.
And so complete lack of connection, of course, is the breeding ground for, you know, for really serious problems. There we're talking about, you know, sociopaths who could care less about how my actions affect anyone. Well, part the extreme opposite of that is forming a good, solid connection, particularly in those early years. And so the first 18 months, it's what I talk about in the books, the first 18 months is the time to connect.
Mm-hmm.
Because the investment that I make there is going to pay off for the rest of my the rest of the child's life.
From day one.
From day one.
Yeah. There, we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. The time just flew by for me.
Great. Psychologist David Walsh has been our guest in this portion of the program. He's the author most recently of Know, Why Kids of All Ages Need to Hear It and Ways Parents Can Say It. The book is now available in a paperback edition with a discussion guide from the Free Press. And our guest, David Walsh, is the president and founder of the National Institute on Media and the Family. And he is, in addition to being the author of the book Know, he's also the author of a number of other books, including Why Do They Act That Way? A Survival Guide to the Adolescent Brain for You and Your Teen. And also he is the author of Dr. Dave's Cyberhood.